You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and RadioCafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Supporting social and emotional needs of students and teachers, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. And many thanks to the Lanl Foundation for supporting the Radio Cafe. Last weekend, I did something that I'd never done in 3 decades of living in New Mexico. I went to Roswell for the annual UFO Festival. On the first day, it was 110 degrees outside, and the place was filled with sweaty, happy aficionados of all things alien and UFO. On today's show, we're going to hear from some people who have devoted their lives to these topics. First, a little history of the famous 1947 event. The mainstream story goes like this. In July of 1947, a flying object crashed at a ranch near Roswell, New Mexico. The headline in the next day's newspaper, the Roswell Daily Record, says RAAF, Roswell Army Airfield, captures flying saucer on ranch in Roswell region. The official story went from flying saucer to weather balloon, and then in the 1990s, the military admitted that it was a nuclear test monitoring balloon. This was, after all, the beginning of the Cold War, 1947, and by the time they admitted it, the Soviet Union was no more. But the flying saucer story sparked the popular imagination and generated streams of science fiction, movies, songs, and popular culture of all kinds. It also sparked fascinating and involved conspiracy theories that include the little gray or green aliens with big eyes that have become virtually the logo of Roswell. You can find them on painted storefronts, carved into statues next to which you can pose and take a picture, and randomly placed pretty much everywhere you look. There was one in the motel lobby where I stayed. The thing that was most fascinating and frankly bizarre for me was to be among hundreds of people, many or most of whom believe in aliens, or non-terrestrials, as I've been told is the politically correct term, or galactically correct. Anyway, a lot of people wore shirts with the words "I believe" printed on them, and a significant number believe that they themselves have been abducted by aliens. The term for them, I learned, is experiencers. Now, the scientific consensus seems to be that the military balloon explanation is correct. Neil deGrasse Tyson said, quote, "The evidence is so paltry for aliens to visit Earth, I have no further interest. Let other people who care go ahead." The late Murray Gell-Mann said that he thought that the evidence for Roswell aliens is, quote, "very, very poor." But in Roswell in July, you'll find a whole lot of people who beg to differ, whether they're focused on the Roswell incident, or conspiracy theories in general, or on alien abduction, or I should say, non-terrestrial experience. So today we're going to hear from several people at the UFO Festival, both official speakers and attendees, and we're going to be talking about some pretty strange stuff. I hope you will hear that I've done what I always do, or try to do, which is keep an open mind and meet people where they are and listen to what they have to say. Okay, so our first guest is Mike Barra. He's a best-selling author of books with titles that include Ancient Aliens on the Moon, Ancient Aliens on Mars, Ancient Aliens and JFK, and Dark Mission, The Secret History of NASA. He calls himself a born-again conspiracy theorist. I asked him what he thought happened in Roswell in July of 1947.
Well, there's really two possibilities that I think are pretty strong. The first one is that there was an actual crash of an alien spacecraft, an alien flying saucer, that something happened, knocked it out of the sky. There was a crash here, and I think that's the most likely scenario based on the evidence that's out there, including the fact that the government said so. So to me, whenever the U.S. government says one thing and then retracts it, you know, an hour later, an hour and a half later, that's a lie. You know it's a lie because they're so quick to shoot it down. And when you have circumstances like that, I mean, I can cite many occasions and many, you know, what made me into a conspiracy theory was TWA 800, which was the 747 that blew up or was shot down just off of New York in 1995, 96. And within an hour, they were telling us it was not a terrorist act, which means, okay, it was a terrorist act, right? Or something, covering something else up. So it's the same thing that applied to the Roswell case, where they did initially come out and tell the truth, and they said, hey, you know, we had a flying disc. We have a flying disc. We have the contents of it, and we're going to ship it back east. And then it was all immediately shot down. And, you know, again, you have lots of other data points. You have the fact that General Ramey, who was the commander of the Roswell airfield at the time, is holding this memo in his hand so that it could be photographed. You know, and of course people have gone back and enhanced it, and it talks about the bodies and the wreckage and the disc, and admits it was a disc. So when they came out with their weather balloon explanation the next day, he was basically signaling to people, if you would look at this picture and read what's on my memo, that it really was something. It really was a disc. So I think all that's very, very solid. Now, I do have an alternative scenario that I think is distinctly possible that I've been looking at for quite a while, which is that if you look at the time period, what was happening at that time, the war had just ended. And one of the interesting things was that what the American forces found was a complete full mock-up of a German aircraft called the Horten HO-229, which was a flying wing design and looked very interestingly like, you know, like it would look like an alien spacecraft back in 1945. Today we have the B-2 self-bomber, so it's not that shocking to us. So you go to the period of 45-46, and Kenneth Arnold, in 47, is flying his airplane near Mount Rainier, Washington, which was a very isolated area at that time. There was McChord Air Force Base and not much else. And he sees these flying saucers. This is what he describes. They're like saucers skipping, and they're very unstable and bouncing around a lot. And when he drew a picture of them, the picture that he drew was basically looks like a flying wing aircraft, a modern flying wing. So as I'm looking at that, I realize that, okay, they were spotted. There was a big thing in the news. All the newspapers, all the TV networks that existed then were talking about Kenneth Arnold's case and the flying saucer. And then 2 weeks later, we have the Roswell crash. So as I look at it and look at the military thinking process, they probably, I believe what those sightings were was probably a bunch of these American-developed from German designs flying wing aircraft, maybe a squadron of them, that they were testing, that Arnold came across and saw and didn't know what they were, didn't recognize them as American aircraft, because they didn't look like anything that we would have ever seen, anybody would have ever seen in the public back in those days. When he saw them and the whole big, you know, thing took place, the whole big media frenzy took place, the Army probably thought, well, you know, we need to test these things in secret, and we thought that this was completely remote, but yet this guy saw our aircraft up there and identified them. So their next move would be to find someplace even more isolated than the Pacific Northwest. And the only, the most obvious place would be Roswell, New Mexico, the middle of literally nowhere, where there was an Army airfield. So it makes a lot of sense to me that they would take that squadron and then move it to someplace like Roswell and do all their testing of the airframes here in an even more isolated environment. But then, what if one of them crashed? Because it does fit the description of what the rancher, Mac Brazel, describes as kind of a wedge-shaped, almost flying wing. So I think there's a distinct possibility that, I would say 10% possibility that it was really a mistaken German flying wing aircraft that had been modified to be tested by the American Army Air Force at that time.
Where do the little gray men fit into that theory?
Well, they don't, because you can't have little gray men, alien bodies, if it's a crash of a German flying wing aircraft, which would, A, only have one pilot, maybe two, but probably two in tandem, but probably only one. So that doesn't fit. But there's a lot of things about the body descriptions that don't fit. I mean, the government's claiming they were crash test dummies that were dropped out by parachute. And that's ridiculous, because that didn't happen until 7 years after the Roswell crash they were doing those tests. So, you know, there's no explanations for it. And you have people who seem to be credible and reliable saying that they did see the bodies. You have documentation like the Majestic 12 documents that describe to then-President-elect Eisenhower the bodies that were recovered, the extraterrestrial biological entities. So there's a paper trail. You know, there's a lot of evidence that totally supports something extraterrestrial. Well, I don't want to say extraterrestrial. Something truly alien crashed here. But there's also a possibility it was something secret. Now, if that's the case, seems to me that the government would have come out a long time ago and said, oh, no, it wasn't aliens. It was, you know, a couple of Horton HO-229 modified American versions we were testing. So that would be, you know, that would be something they could come out and say, because it wouldn't be classified technology in 2019. It would have been in 1947, but that's a long time ago now, so.
And that was author and conspiracy theorist Mike Barra. We now turn to Kathleen Marden. She's author or co-author of many books, including The Alien Abduction Files, Extraterrestrial Contact, What to Do When You've Been Abducted, The UFO Cover-Up, What World Governments Don't Want You to Know, and Science Was Wrong. She is known in UFO circles for her publications on the case of her aunt and uncle, Betty and Barney Hill, who claim to have been abducted by aliens and taken onto a UFO in New Hampshire late one night in September 1961. Marden was a psychiatric social worker and an educator before she began to devote her life to the investigation of this case. I asked her to describe her aunt and uncle's abduction experience.
For Betty, when she was on that craft, she was extremely frightened initially. She was captured. She was taken on board the craft. There was a physical examination. But when a needle was inserted into her navel and she experienced a tremendous amount of pain, the one that she called the leader, who was standing next to her, took her pain away. And as a result of that, she began to trust him. So when the examiner left the room to examine Barney in a different room, Betty struck up a conversation. This was all telepathic. She might have been talking with words, but he wasn't. And she said, "I know you're not from around here. Where are you from?" And he produced a star map and showed her the star map. There were a number of stars on it, two in the foreground that were the size of like nickels, and then others that were much smaller than that, and others that were just pinpoints. And some of these had trade routes, so they would travel back and forth.
The aliens from the different star systems were traveling back and forth and trading with each other?
They did not give Betty that information.
What do you think aliens are doing here? Why are they poking needles into humans? What's going on?
Well, I want to tell you that this is what I am most interested in. I work with scientists who have PhDs on social studies of experiencers.
Experiencers means people who have had an experience of UFOs?
Yes, that's what I call them. We used to use the word abductee. But it was brought to our attention that not everyone considers themselves as abductees. There are people who are having positive experiences with these non-human entities and have asked for this to happen. So we have worked on academic studies, and we asked a lot of these questions. What do you think is happening? And what we found is that those who are interacting with the gray type of alien, which is fairly stereotypical, are having genetic material removed from their bodies, ova, sperm. They also have skin samples taken from time to time.
So humans are being taken into spaceships and having their own genetic material removed by aliens.
Yes, that's what thousands of people who have had this kind of experience say. That's what all of the major researchers in the field, such as myself, say. That is one of our findings.
And so why?
So why are they doing this? Well, experiencers also have seen artificial gestational tanks on the craft. And they have seen fetuses in various stages of development. Some of the fetuses resemble the grays. Some of the fetuses are kind of a cross between grays and humans. And then others look completely human.
So the next step, why are they gestating aliens humans and apparent hybrids of the two?
Yes. You know, that's a really good question. And it has to go to the questions we asked with regard to their experiencers' communication with these non-human entities. And what the experiencers say is that they are here doing this for our benefit and theirs. And so they had difficulty with the reproductive process, and they're trying to save their own race, and they're using our genetic material to do that. But also there's another part of it, and they're very concerned, they say, about human behavior, that we're very primitive, and they are attempting to make positive changes. They come back, they say, from time to time to assist in our development, and they say that this is one of the times that they are here to assist in our development because they're concerned that we could destroy our planet, that we're pretty primitive and warlike. During the 20th century, we killed nearly 200 million of our own kind on this planet in major and minor wars and famines as a result of wars. And I have to tell you that I have done studies, too, on the changes that take place in people who have been contacted and taken to craft. And the results is very much like what we think of as near-death experiencers have. Abductees become more psychic, telepathic, intuitive. They become empathic. There seems to be a spike in their level of intelligence. They seem to suddenly have knowledge that they hadn't possessed earlier. They become more spiritual.
An obvious question that presents itself is that if our DNA and alien DNA are close enough that they can be hybridized, they must originally be from Earth or we from somewhere else because we have virtually the same DNA. I mean, it's, you can, for example, you can hybridize, you know, a dog and a coyote or a dog and a wolf because they're so close, but you can't hybridize a dog and a cat, mm-hmm. right? So what's going on there?
Well, I think that there is DNA manipulation that's taking place. There might be gene splicing.
But they have genes.
Yes, they would have, you know, we're assuming that they have genes.
Right. So in other words, do you think that, or are you asking the question of what their origin is and how it relates to ours?
The Greys aren't giving people that information as far as I know. I don't have all of the answers. No one does. We don't know for sure. And I don't like to do a lot of speculating. I look for statistical evidence.
How do you, I mean, you have a background in psychiatric social work.
Mm-hmm.
How do you differentiate those who are delusional, which exists in this world? Mm-hmm. I mean, there are crazy people. There's
absolutely
a lot of them.
Yes.
How do you differentiate between those who are mentally ill, delusional, and those who, in your view, are having genuine experiences?
Well, it's very easy because the experiences are different. You can see that they're delusional. For the most part, those individuals have just absolutely horrible experiences beyond anything that you could even imagine.
So the people who are mentally ill and delusional have bad UFO experiences, and
yes.
Those who are, you know, legitimate have good experiences?
No, not necessarily. It's just that I have found that, for example, let me give you some examples. There was a man who was insisting that he was being abducted, and that every day in his home, he was having aliens enter his mouth, come out of his mouth, come out of his ears. You know, that's clearly delusional. He was hallucinating. That's not what aliens do.
So what do aliens do? I mean, you've told us some things. What have you not told us about what aliens do?
Well, there are a variety of different types. You have the short grays who are about 3.5 feet tall to 4 feet tall.
And that's sort of like the archetypal Roswell alien with the big heads and the big eyes.
Yes, and those little ones tend to, you know, as a joke, we call them the bellboys or the bellhops, because they're the ones who, they do the menial labor. They remove people's clothing, they put it back on, they escort people on the craft. There's also a taller type, about 4.5 to 5.5 feet tall. These are the more intelligent grays who work as the physicians on the craft, as the translators, as the educators, and they will see the experiencer time and time again throughout their lifetime. Sometimes these taller grays work with the insectoid or mantis type. That's just about 20%. There's also the human type. So next to the reports by grays is the human type in percentages. After the human type, we have the insectoid type and then the reptilian type, which is generally reported by less than 20% of the experiencers, according to my study.
What are your hopes for your research?
Well, I have to tell you, before I die, I would like to find the answers. I'd like to know more than we know.
What are the two or three main questions that you would like to have the answers to?
I would like to know why they're here. Definitely. Why are they really here? We know what they tell people, but are they telling the truth? That's a big question. I'd like to know more about their technology.
Like how they get spacecraft across light years of distance?
Well, for that, and how they can pass the human body through a solid surface, because they do that. And now I've talked to 3 astrophysicists, and each one of them has told me that everything vibrates theoretically at a frequency. And remember that 99.9% of the atom is empty space. And so if you can align frequency and phase, then atoms can interpenetrate. That was big news to me. They said that we certainly don't have the technology to do that, but we have on a very tiny, tiny scale in a laboratory. So we know that it is possible. So it's those kinds of scientific things that I would like to know the answers to. I'd like to know how long they've been coming here and why.
And that was author and UFO researcher Kathleen Marden. Next, we're going to hear from Yvonne Smith. She's a certified hypnotherapist and founder of the Close Encounters Resource Organization and runs support groups for alien experiencers. Her practice comprises 98% people who feel that they've had an alien abduction experience. I asked her why she thought that people's alien abduction experiences weren't dreams.
You don't know that initially. You have to go back to the person's background history, family history. It's a family affair. There's a family connection with this. It's not just one person by themselves. So when I sent out my life history questionnaire, I sent a couple questionnaires out, and I asked about, have your parents or grandparents and so forth had experiences? The person who comes to me doesn't just have one dream. You know, they've had years of maybe a recurring dream, which is an indication that there's an unresolved issue in the subconscious mind. So there's just, you know, it's a history of maybe very vivid dreams of seeing strange things in the sky, maybe waking up with marks on their body. It's not just, oh, one dream here and, oh, I think, you know, I want to see if I've ever been abducted.
When you say marks on their body, what do you mean?
They come up overnight with triangular-shaped marks or scars on their body that were not there the night before. They'll come up they look like injection marks in a triangular shape, or a bruise, or layers of skin removed, but in a triangular shape. So it's a little bit more difficult to explain away of how someone bruises or receives marks in that particular shape.
Why a triangle?
Triangles seem to be very important in their society. They're often seen three ships at a time or three bright lights at a time in the sky. When they enter someone's home, they are often, there's three of them together. Or if they stop a car on the highway, there's often three. So it seems like that Trinity, for whatever reason, I mean, in here in religious areas, like I was brought up Catholic, I'm not practicing anymore, but it represents Father, Son, Holy Ghost, or Holy Spirit. But who knows what it means in their society.
So what are some examples of the common stories, the common threads that people are telling you about their experiences?
Commonly, they'll describe how if they're at home and say in bed reading, they'll often see a very bright light coming into their room or their home. They're rendered paralyzed. All of a sudden they realize they can't move anything but their eyes. And then there's usually a blackout period. Sometimes they will see consciously the beings that have come into their room. And there'll be three surrounding
Smith
their
describes
bed.
An abduction scenario very similar to sometimes what Kathleen Marden described in pretty much the same language. Small gray aliens, bigger ones, mantis beings, type, medical probings in which human DNA is
they'll
harvested.
They'll describe an insect-looking one, very tall.
So, okay, let me just summarize what I understand. Aliens are coming in spaceships, abducting people, taking their DNA, creating hybrids of them and us, and leaving them here on Earth for reasons that we don't know.
Reason we don't. Now, my colleague, Dr. David Jacobs, who's now retired, in his last book, Walking Among Us, he has cases where some of the abductees are training these hybrids how to live down here, how to dress like us, how to live in an apartment, pay their rent, go to the grocery store. Now, I haven't come across that. David Jacobs feels that they're down here to basically take us over. And I may be naive, or I just want to think positive, but I just don't feel that.
I asked Yvonne Smith about whether her clients were able to talk about their UFO and abduction experiences with others, with those outside of UFO circles.
Hopefully, yes. When I started this, of course, that seemed to be so impossible. You know, just even talking about it. But now I think we're making strides. And beginning with shows like the History Channel Unidentified, when you hear pilots, Navy pilots, who are highly trained individuals who describe their experience when they saw these things flying around. They call it a giant tic-tac. And how they were afraid that it could have caused a mid-air collision. One flew right between two jets. Now, if that doesn't cause people to stand up and, you know, think, what the heck is going on? And who's flying these things? I think bringing that out into the open, hearing credible people talk about their experience while they're flying up there, I feel that we're starting to make strides. And I think where the gay population, I mean, I have followed them. I've seen documentaries from when it first started, how they were just being persecuted and losing jobs and all of that. I said, my God, it sounds like an abductee.
Are abductees being persecuted
and
losing jobs?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's why they're afraid to talk about it. I don't dare talk to a coworker unless they know that person for a very long time, you know, like a good friend, you know, and afraid of losing standing in the community. I mean, this is ridiculous. I mean, to me, it's like 2019, just because someone mentions UFO, they're going to be persecuted for it. And that's thanks to our government is putting out misinformation and disinformation for 70 years and putting out real information by individuals who are not so credible. So then that causes that began that ridicule factor.
Do you, at this point, because I can imagine that when you started this work, there was some skepticism, like, what are we looking at here? Do you feel a sense of skepticism? Are you quite sure that people are being abducted by aliens and brought back and hybridization and little gray men and all that thing? Do you feel that that is real?
Oh, I do absolutely feel it is real after, and like I said, because in my position, I work with them very intimately, one-on-one, in their family members. I'm not just hearing stories. And I see the emotion and what, and that it affects their children, you know, down the line. And they're very upset about when their children begin to have experiences. Of course, any parent, anyone who has children knows. I've been convinced now for several years that, yes, there is something. This is a physical event. It's not something that, you know, just out of body or it's a dream. I mean, this is a physical event. People are gone and family members have looked for them and can't find them. So they're actually physically gone. And, you know, we're at the point now where, okay, we have to really take this seriously and allow people to talk about it.
That was hypnotherapist and founder of the Close Encounters Resource Organization, Yvonne Smith. We end today's show with Erin Montgomery. She lives in Roswell and has a Facebook blog called Dirty Little Secrets. She's also a hypnotherapy client of Yvonne Smith, and she's a self-described experiencer and abductee. I asked her how she would describe herself with respect to alien contact.
I originally thought of myself as an abductee taken against my will. However, now when I have experiences, I recognize the beings. I can say, oh, hello, nice to see you again, and go willingly, whether that's apathy or if they've created that atmosphere for me, I'm not sure. But when it happens, I am not feeling like I'm being taken against my will any longer.
Does it happen in the middle of the night when you're sleeping or when you're going about your business in the day or what?
For me, it's always in the middle of the night. Whether I'm asleep or not is questionable. Sometimes I'm asleep and I'm awakened. Other times I'm asleep and I don't realize what's happened until the next morning and I have bruises. So, you know, there's no memories at all whatsoever. And there are times when I am awake and they will come into the room and I usually know that they're coming and just have a sense that, okay, tonight's a night. And in the past, I would be absolutely terrified and afraid to sleep.
So what are these experiences like? Like, describe, if you don't mind.
I don't mind.
A typical experience or a couple of distinct experiences that you've had.
Okay, let's see. The first experience I can remember, and Yvonne helped me develop some of the or regain the memories in hypnosis. I was around 7 years old. I woke up and there were three beings at the end of my bed. I don't remember being afraid of them or anything, but they lifted me up. They levitated me out of the bed and floated me into the hallway, and then we dematerialized, basically, and went up through the ceiling, through the roof, and into a beam of light, into a ship that was above the house. On the ship, there were many other humans with beings that were taking them around, just like me, with the three gray beings, you know, the typical 3 foot, 4 foot tall gray beings. And I was taken into a room that had a chair very similar to a dentist chair. And I was put into the chair, and then I saw a very tall being whose face I cannot recall, and I became absolutely terrified at that point. I was screaming, and they were trying to calm me down in any way that they could, and they actually inserted something into the roof of my mouth. After talking with Yvonne, like, what is in the body around the roof of the mouth, and we decided that's where the pituitary gland is. So it was some sort of implant placed in that area. It's never shown up on any CAT scans or anything that I've had, so I don't know. A lot of this, was I dreaming? I don't know.
Well,
that's the question. Am I just crazy? I don't know. But I have these memories.
I mean, that's something that I wanted to ask you. I mean, how do you know it's not a dream?
Oftentimes I don't. When I have an experience and I feel like it's a dream, but it's not, I will have bruises, marks, other sort of indications that things have happened.
What do they look like?
Oftentimes fingerprints, like I'll have a handprint on the inside of my thighs, which can be very, very disturbing. Like how did I get handprints on the inside of my thighs in the middle of the night?
A handprint like a human hand?
It's usually three fingers, like three bruises along each thigh, on the inner thigh.
So how long have you been aware of this and examining all of this in your life?
This started when I was about 19 years old, when I started to become afraid of looking in the night sky. Just all of a sudden, I was afraid to look up. Things that just did not make sense, and there was no trauma that I could recall that would explain this. I had gone to a talk by Stanton Friedman at the time, and it was at NMSU, which is New Mexico State University.
Stanton Friedman being one of the UFO researchers who wrote many books for many years.
Yeah, exactly. I'd never really thought about it at that point in time. I was always into the paranormal, ghosts, witches, all those things always interested me. But I'd never been afraid until that point. And then the memory started to surface.
How did they surface?
Almost like a flashback. All of a sudden there's a flash or a picture in your mind. I would have dreams of ships and things like that, or beings. And yeah, so just little bits, little snippets would come.
So where are you at now? Like, how do you understand your experience at this point?
That's a good question. At this point, after looking into this for about 25 years, because I'm 44 now, having recalled several experiences as a child, having more experiences as an adult, and now seeing my children have experiences themselves, gaining information about my grandfather having experiences, knowing that my father has seen many, many things, and, you know, that family line, my grandfather, my dad, his sister, all of the children involved there, and now my children. I know that this is not something that can be avoided. I was a librarian for a long time. You know, that was my career. And then all of a sudden I decided I needed to go back to school, and I felt pushed, and I went into psychology. I have a master's in therapy. So that, I think, was guided. But I also think that it's really important for me to understand PTSD and how to help people put those, not fears, but the trauma to bed, because I think it is very important for us to be able to, us meaning experiencers, abductees, contactees, whatever, to be able to process what is happening in the moment with the aliens. Because if we just go straight into the fight or flight, we're not going to be able to interact, we're not going to be able to logically understand what is happening around us if we just disappear into fear.
So if you don't disappear into fear and you have a contact with aliens, what happens then? I mean, do you talk to each other?
Yes, I think so. The last experience I had was, that I remember anyways, was back in October 2018. I was awakened from a strange nightmare about not really a nightmare, but a dream about being in a haunted house, and the covers were being pulled off of me. And I thought maybe this is my husband, you know, turning over and just pulling the covers off. We fight over blankets all the time. However, the blankets were being pulled in the opposite direction of where my husband was. So that startled me awake. And there were three beings in the room, and I didn't recognize two of them, but one of them I did. He was a very tall, chalky white being. His face resembled E.T. I recognized him, and I said, "Oh, hey, it's you." And I just reached out my hand and was okay with going. I don't remember a lot of the experience, but being able to say, "Oh, hi, it's you," and have a familiarity and feeling comfortable is much better than being terrified and screaming and fighting and as you would if you were in the middle of the traumatized emotions.
What do you think this all means? What are aliens doing coming to Erin Montgomery's bedroom?
That is a good question. One thing I think is that they're following the bloodlines. If I have contact, you know, four generations now of contact through my family, they're monitoring us for something. I don't know if they're manipulating DNA. I don't know what they're doing. I also know that there are so many different types that we don't know what all their agendas are. And I still don't know the agendas of the ones that are coming to visit me. However, I do know that the messages that many contactees, abductees, experiencers come out with are, we need to protect the planet. We need to love one another and be peaceful. And we need to, you know, gather ourselves and prepare for a different way of life. Internally, and being comfortable with ourselves. Those are the three major messages that are received.
Sounds like good common sense.
Exactly, which makes you say, okay, so if these are the messages, then how bad can this be?
Erin Montgomery, thank you for being with us.
No, thank you for inviting me.
And there you have it. Ladies and gentlemen, that's our show for today. Make of it what you will. Roswell UFO Festival 2019. If you've gotten this far, thank you so much for listening. Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Funding learning initiatives and community programs, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. And many thanks to the Lanham Foundation for support of the Radio Cafe. You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send us any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.